Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, back in the driver's seat to take you on another journey into the heart of darkness. In this episode, we're returning to November 4th, 2018 in Cumming, Georgia, when 40-year-old wife and mother of five, Tamala Horsford, was found dead in the backyard of a friend, seemingly the victim of a tragic accident involving a fall from a second floor deck. Or was she? But first, just a quick and very sincere thank you to my Patreon supporters, and also, if anyone would like to donate to the show, you can do so through the website coldcasemurdermysteries.com. As always, your support is greatly appreciated, and please remember that 5-star reviews help others to find this show's listing in what is an endless queue of true crime offerings available to today's listeners. Okay, let's do this. So, what we're examining today is a case with significant racial tensions in relation to the mystery of what really happened. And beyond that, the perception of the case in the public eye is just as divisive. Some see this as a simple accident, and others believe it's murder. But the truth remains fleeting despite the investigations. Let's start at the beginning of the event in question. It's November 3rd, 2018, and Tamala Horsford is scheduled to attend a birthday party at a friend's home. While Tamala is black, the rest of the women attending are white, which seems a very realistic ratio considering the county in which this occurs has a population that is 96% white. Of course, in such a place, racism is likely still rampant, and history seems to confirm as much, though we don't specifically know to what extent it might have played a role in the outcome of this tale. What we can say is that the homeowner in question had a Latino boyfriend at the time, and he was present that night. She also invited Tamala to the party, so any preconceived or premeditated notion of violence against Tamala Horsford as a result of race is probably a bit of a stretch. Now, these women are gathering to have a slumber party, like you would have when you were 12, but with a whole lot of alcohol involved, so the plan is for everybody to stay overnight and not drive home. Again, the general plan is that they are going to play Cards Against Humanity and also watch a football game, specifically Alabama versus LSU. The ladies intend to watch the game upstairs on the main floor, while downstairs, in the finished basement, the homeowner's boyfriend Jose will be joined by another man who is the husband of an attendee upstairs. Apparently, this man decided to join his wife at the party because their college-age daughter was throwing her own party back at their place and he didn't want to be around for it. Now, Alabama versus LSU is obviously a big rivalry game that generates a lot of interest in that region, but on this night, Alabama smokes LSU 29-0, which is probably why we learn that both Jose and this other man come upstairs to mingle, so to speak, at halftime of the game. So, as they were separated when the game started, it seems that everybody was sort of partying together by halftime. It's not known exactly when Tamala arrives at the party, as one account has her arriving at 8:30 p.m. after everybody else, while another suggests she was there for a group photo before the game started. Even another person suggested that photo took place at halftime. There are a lot of inconsistencies in relation to when people arrived and what happened thereafter. And that's led to a lot of suspicion arising moving forward. But in all honesty, the reason these people probably don't remember all of the details is because they were drunk at a party where such things wouldn't really have very much value unless considered in retrospect after the incident. Again, only in retrospect do any of these things have relevance. If two people disagree about what time Tamala arrived, or all of them disagree, it simply does not equate to murder. The optics in this case are admittedly very bad. When you hear that the only black woman at a party was the one who died under mysterious circumstances, and it happened in a historically racist place prone to violence, a perception is created, one that can't be ignored. And it shouldn't be. I do think that in cases like this one, we need to indulge a greater degree of diligence due to historical sensitivity. There is often not the same level of trust afforded law enforcement when the victim is black, and for a good reason, which again is documented historically. Yet, in doing so, I believe we have to proceed rationally despite any overwhelming feelings. Emotion plays a big part in this case, and along with the issues caused by insufficient investigation on the part of law enforcement, it's clouded the pursuit of truth. While this case is literally a black and white issue in some ways, the truth is never any color but gray, so we need to use that lens in determining the reality. There isn't anything I can do here to prove what did or did not transpire, but what I can do is take you on a tour of all of the elements that are being ignored in favor of trying to solidify false narratives derived from emotion. Let's ask, how is it built? And I promise you, we will find significant clues that nobody else has considered. On that note, let's start with the house. This is an upper-middle-class home in a suburban neighborhood, one with a traditional front yard and a driveway leading from the street to a garage that is attached to the house. So, from the front of the home, you would see a large, two-story structure, basically McMansion style. It has a ground floor for the main living areas, like the living room and kitchen. Then upstairs, on the second floor, is a typical layout of bedrooms. However, if you go to the back of the home, you quickly learn that the facade from the front conceals the actual structure of the house. The front yard and the front of the home, from that vantage point, are sitting on flat ground. But once you travel past the fence into the backyard, you see that the backyard, and by extension, the rear portion of the house, are actually located on a slope going downhill. So, if you're facing the back of the house as opposed to the front, you see three floors instead of two. Back there, the basement is at ground level with the yard, and the main floor, which is the first floor from a vantage point out front, then becomes the second floor out back because the slope exposes the basement. So the basement is completely underground out front, but out back, it leads out a ground-level door onto a large patio that runs the length of the house horizontally. That patio is covered in landscaping pebbles, and on top of that surface, they have a seating setup of chairs and a coffee table. A metal rim, perhaps an inch or two tall, lines the border of the patio to keep the pebbles in place. Outside that metal rim, extending onto the area that meets the lawn, is another perimeter made of larger stones, which is maybe, at most, a couple of feet wide. If facing the back patio at ground level, the door leading into the basement is near the left end of the house. The homeowner's aunt, who was present at the party upstairs and who would allegedly find the body the next morning when she came out the door to check the weather or look out the window, depending on the version you hear, lives in the finished basement at the time. Now, that patio is actually covered because above it, leading out from the main floor, specifically the kitchen, is a wooden deck or balcony that also runs the length of the house like the patio, and also extends the same distance away from the home. That deck is also covered from above, but as opposed to the one downstairs, this one is clearly intended for entertaining guests, as it has much nicer furniture, larger tables, and a gas grill. There are 8 evenly spaced wooden poles running vertically across the lower patio as support for the deck above, and then 8 to match, doing the same above to hold up the deck's roof. Tamla's body is discovered on the morning of November 4th, 2018, perhaps around 8:30 a.m., face down in the grass with both arms at her sides, palms up. There's a little bit of controversy here in the sense that one of her arms was moved, allegedly, when someone went to take her pulse, specifically a police officer. So, at first glance, one's impression would likely be that she fell from the balcony above, specifically the area between the third and fourth support poles, if we're counting from left to right. By her feet, we see scattered stones from the outer perimeter of landscaping rocks, which have made their way onto the grass in a manner that suggests they were dragged by Tamla's feet. There's a circular spot of blood on the right wrist area, or cuff, of her white pajamas, which shows a dark red spot, or point of origin for a wound, which then spreads outward and becomes increasingly lighter, or pink, as it does, suggesting an injury beneath. That wrist, in fact, will be discovered severely swollen, and what partygoers and police initially claim is a cut on Tamla's wrist actually turns out to be the result of a sharp compound fracture in which the bone protruded from the skin, leaving the blood spreading outward from that point to be soaked up by the clothing. Now, as the public, we don't have much to go on here in terms of photographic evidence beyond the fractured wrist, but what we are told is that Tamla had multiple blunt force injuries to her head, as well as a potential fracture to her spine, along with other assorted scratches, cuts, and bruises on her arms and legs. We should also mention that she had, perhaps, a laceration of the heart. So, the initial impression this event offers is that Tamla likely fell from the deck above, but with multiple blunt force injuries to the head, it makes you pause. If you fall from a second floor balcony, you only hit the ground once, and therefore the injuries on Tamla's body should be indicative of a single hard impact, not several. So people rush right to the notion of murder because this doesn't make sense. But with all due respect to anyone who has been hurt by this incident, I have to tell you the things that make murder very inconvenient in this scenario. So let's backtrack for a moment to the night before and look at the story we're told about what led to this death. We're told that everyone is scheduled to stay overnight for this slumber party, but no fewer than 4 of these women will leave during the night. Supposedly, a few people left by 10:30 p.m. Now, Tamla was drinking tequila and water and had brought a bottle as a gift for the homeowner, but apparently she didn't drink tequila and therefore skipped it, and Tamla was the one who decided to consume the tequila. So, Tamla had smoked cigarettes throughout the night, periodically walking out the back door from the kitchen onto the deck to do so. According to the homeowner, on one of these occasions, Tamla began to smoke weed, but her friend asked her to stop because her boyfriend Jose, one of the men watching the game in the basement, was a pretrial officer and didn't approve of it. Let me just say that there is a photo of Tamla at this party with the homeowner and another friend that's available online. And again, it was taken at the party, and in it, the 3 of them all have red, glassy eyes. And to me, all appear to be stoned. I'm not suggesting they might be stoned. I'm saying it's so obvious that they should be ashamed of trying to lie like that. Not only do I think weed was smoked, but I firmly believe multiple people in the household smoked it with Tamla. They look like they did. Now, just like people do with booze, a la the tequila, parties can precipitate the same thing happening with drugs. So, in essence, what is marijuana? If you were to classify it in terms of medical purpose, what would it be? Well, it's basically anti-anxiety medication. That's what most recreational drugs are. They take the edge off. So we soon learn in the autopsy that Tamela had Xanax in her system when she died. What is Xanax? Anti-anxiety medication. Yet Tamela didn't have any Xanax, so she didn't bring it to the party. Now, Tamela shows up with tequila, and we know the intention, again, is to reduce social anxiety. She offers it to other people, or shares. In turn, the homeowner, who is drinking vodka, is obviously making that available to Tamela if she wants it. They're sharing. People do that. So, when Tamela breaks out the weed, the same inclination would occur. So, very likely, anybody at the party who had anti-anxiety drugs at this point would share with Tamela in order to reciprocate. People who are drinking socially want others to do it with them. Likewise, people who are using drugs socially want others to do it with them. That's how the joint was invented. You pass it around, right? So just like people bring different types of booze to share at parties, the same regularly occurs with drugs. Of course, we soon learn one of the partygoers is not only a regular Xanax user and somebody who suffers from significant anxiety, but she had this medication with her at the party as well. Yet, she tells the cops that she knows it's a controlled substance and would never share it with anyone, something that was debunked almost immediately when they learned she not only lied, but had truly shared her Xanax with another person as recently as the day prior to Tamela's death. So if Tamela had taken Xanax but didn't bring any, we can assume but not prove that she got it from that person at the party and likely because she was kind enough to share her weed. Now, what thematic element is shining up in bright lights as we learn this information? It is not murder. It's what? Liability. We have all sorts of people screaming about murder, but the truth about conniving white people like this is that they are motivated by liability. Not for one second do I think Tamela got beaten to death at a women's slumber party. But the liability starts here. And like we know from the Ramseys, McCanns, and a plethora of other white upper-middle-class suspects, they will go to any lengths necessary to avoid it and specifically use whatever privilege they have. Most people like these folks, and especially women, don't commit brutal murders involving blunt force trauma. They get caught in a dilemma due to an accident, and because they have too much to lose, they manifest a false reality pointing to innocence. It's this simple. If you're poor and somebody has an accident in your home in which you might be liable, from a civil standpoint involving damages, you just tell the truth because you don't have much to lose. But if you have money, property, and other assets, making such mistakes is often going to be very costly. Poor people couldn't care less about the prospect of getting sued. White, upper-middle-class people, however, understand that, in their world, if you fuck up, nobody is coming for you with a knife and a gun to get revenge. Instead, it's a lawyer, and they can be ruthless in trying to take everything you have because they're financially invested in those endeavors. So, instead of murder, let's move forward under a more realistic notion of liability, and I think you'll see, as I have, that the evidence suggests all the lies and inconsistencies present are derived, or seemingly derived, from people trying to avoid liability in an accidental death. Now again, we know Tamela has marijuana and Xanax in her system, along with enough alcohol to constitute a 0.238 blood alcohol level. I often hear this referred to as nearly three times the legal limit, which is absolutely fucking ridiculous because there is no legal limit for people drinking at home in their pajamas. That number refers to the legal limit for the driver of a motor vehicle, and even then is not indicative of measuring intoxication. Rather, it simply sets the bar for what the law finds acceptable when driving a vehicle. There are those who believe that the assessment of .238 is a fabrication, and that Tamela was not drunk, proven by the accounts of those at the party corroborating that she did not seem intoxicated. People who think this was murder are like, see, see, even the people at the party say she wasn't drunk, and that means the BAC is a lie, and she was murdered by way of a savage beating. Again, very respectfully, no. Those people at the party are saying she wasn't drunk because it limits their liability to the greatest extent possible. If someone does not appear intoxicated, then taking no action to stop her from doing whatever led to her death wouldn't have occurred to you. However, if she was wasted and you say, yeah, she was lit, then you acknowledge to the cops that you understood her condition to be unsafe and allowed her to proceed into risky activities resulting in her death. If you're concerned with liability, you play ignorant and let the BAC do the talking. They did. It says that she was quite intoxicated, but other people couldn't see it. That's what they're trying to convey. In that light, Tamela is responsible for her own consumption, but the actual construction of the house playing a role in the accident is another matter. If your house is built in a manner that indulges unnecessary risk, or even risk that goes against building code, and an accident occurs leading to death, your liability could be sky high. So to this point, I've intentionally refrained from telling you about a very significant element of the construction of the home because, for all intents and purposes, I wanted to mimic the willful ignorance that most presentations of this case offer. Now think of the injuries again. Blunt force trauma, including multiple wounds to the head, a compound fracture to the right wrist, a possible fracture of the spine, and other assorted cuts, scratches, or bruises on the arms and legs. We have people very firmly asserting that these have to be defensive wounds because a fall from the deck railing above wouldn't produce the totality of what we find on the body and wouldn't be the result of a single fall from a height believed to be approximately only 15 feet. A lot of people are focused on the deck railing above the body as the point of the fall, and think that since the injuries don't align with that single drop, Tamela must have been murdered. But again, let's put the murder aside for now and focus on this, liability. In the absence of murder, why would somebody place the deceased in a location other than where the accident occurred? Think liability. If you have the liability in relation to construction as the homeowner, how do you turn the tables to put the liability on Tamela instead? Well, you mirror that idea by making her liable in relation to construction. So let's go there now, and we'll start by revealing the missing element, which, again, to me, it's just shocking that no one is talking about this. There is a big outdoor staircase connecting the patio below with the deck above, and very few people are even willing to mention that it is absolutely a perfect vehicle for Tamela enduring an accident in which it seems she fell multiple times and endured multiple blunt force injuries to her head. For whatever reason, the staircase is like this big dirty secret. Why is it being ignored? The answer is that it betrays both the innocent accident and murder narratives. It falls in between, in a gray area in which there truly was an accident, and also truly was a subsequent cover-up related not to murder, but the liability of people who supplied a controlled substance prior to allowing an intoxicated person to navigate an unnecessarily dangerous design element of the home. Now, why do I call this staircase unnecessarily dangerous? The police photos, in my opinion, while intentionally few in number, also forego any type of decent view of the staircase as it appears up on the deck. Why? They photographed it with great clarity below on the patio, but when they took pictures of the deck above and also of the deck from the yard, they seemingly went out of their way to avoid showing the top of that staircase. So I want to know why they did that. And all I have to do, if I find the answer, is mirror the truth, and we'll get the opposite, or reflection, of their intentions present in Tamala's death. It can't be avoided in construction. That's why I choose to examine design elements. If you know how it's built, you know how they had to reverse that construction in a sociopathic rendering of altered truth in which light is redirected. All of which is to say that, even though the cops avoided any direct photography involving the top of the stairs on the deck, a shot they took from the backyard offers enough clarity to make the absence of one thing very prominent. A railing. When you look at the bottom of the stairs going up from the view on the patio, there's a hand railing you can hold as you walk. But when you look at the top of the stairwell, or the area where it would be up on the deck, there's nothing. This is an area where there would normally be something like a banister or a railing, maybe even a wall, but at least some type of protective barrier that prevents a person from falling into the open stairwell from above. It means a person could not only fall down the stairs from tripping as they descended while walking, but also that someone could actually fall into the stairwell itself like a hole from multiple sides. Now, in the photo, you can't actually see that open stairwell on the deck floor because it's taken from the yard below. But in the place where there would need to be a railing or a wall or some type of protective barrier, you can actually see the continuation of a drain pipe running up the back of the house on the right side. From that angle, if there was anything protecting the stairwell, it would block, or at least partially block, the view of the drain pipe at that level of the house. But it doesn't. You see the whole drain pipe. Now, let's ask ourselves, if Tamala fell down the stairs because the owner neglected to put in a railing, how do we reverse those elements in a sociopathic narrative designed to negate the homeowner's liability? Well, simple. You'd create a scenario in which the negligence is not only placed upon Tamala instead of the homeowner, but that it also happens in a situation in which there was a railing to stop her, which becomes the notion that she ignored the danger of sitting on the deck railing or ignored design elements of the home involving safety. It mirrors what the owner did, but with the intention of reversing the liability onto Tamala instead of her. The homeowner should have put in a railing around that staircase. So instead, she puts the liability on Tamala by saying that Tamala misused the railing that was there. Now, most people miss the sitting on the railing narrative, and not by any fault of their own. they think of the fall in the context of falling over the railing while standing on the deck and refuse to budge on that logic simply because it then allows the fall to seem impossible, leading to insinuations of murder. But again, let's instead go back to construction and the idea of redirection of light or truth. Manipulation, right? The photo taken directly on the deck shows a very clean space. In fact, one that is nearly immaculate. Something quite odd given the fact there was a party at the house hours earlier in which people were regularly using the deck. But for that reason, it's much easier to see whatever is out of place, meaning what they couldn't remove. What we see in the exact spot where Tamla would have started her fall, if indeed she did fall from the deck onto the yard, is a lone propane canister. It's in the absolute worst place possible on the deck, meaning far away from the grill and also in a spot where it prevents people from easily walking past it. Every other spot on the deck, is a much better place than where this thing is resting. It's completely nonsensical. It's ridiculous. So if it doesn't fit there, why is it sitting there, especially when everything else on the deck is perfectly organized and sensibly placed? Well, the first image that popped into my mind upon seeing the propane tank, even before doing any analysis, is that it looked like the perfect place to rest your feet if you were sitting on the railing. It would also serve as a stepping stool for propping yourself up on the railing or even letting yourself down. But think about that. What's the problem with using both the railing and the propane tank like that? They weren't built for those purposes, and an adult like Tamla, if she chose to ignore those design elements, if she shunned the necessity of construction, would pay a price indicative of liability she created rather than the homeowner. But if Tamla falls down the stairs because there isn't a railing and someone at the house gave her a controlled substance, liability rests squarely on their shoulders instead. I don't know what local ordinances, etc. require, but regardless of legality, those stairs were obviously dangerous enough that law enforcement refrained from photographing them, or at least providing photos of them. Now again, watch how sociopathic narratives work. The homeowner's boyfriend, Jose, claims that he found an unlit cigarette and a lighter on the deck the morning they also discovered the body. But he removed those items from that location, insinuating that Tamla had fallen in the process of going to smoke. That's consistent with the idea of hopping onto the rail and losing your balance. It would happen before you lit the cigarette. Except there's no cigarette and no lighter either, because he took them. He moved them. Yet what we do have in that place is a propane tank. Now think about the symbolic implications of the propane tank and grill being separated, just like the cigarette and the lighter. In that case, what's true? Both the cigarette and grill can't do what? They can't be lit. Now, let's ask ourselves why this man would divert attention from the grill by putting the propane tank far away along the railing. Well, that's not a difficult one to answer because the photos show us that the grill is right next to the top of the stairwell on the deck. There's this subtle but incessant need here to prove that both the unseen cigarette and the grill without the propane tank aren't capable of lighting. Now think of lighting a gas grill. It's always just a little bit scary because of the flammability factor. But what causes that initial anxiety is often that burst of energy when the flame ignites and instantaneously expands outward. In fact, a lot of accidents, or most accidents, involving gas grills occur that way because ignition, whether you're lighting a grill, starting a car, or launching a rocket, requires tremendous energy. The flame shooting outward on a grill can be unsettling, and if you've never personally used the grill you're lighting, then you might not be prepared for the extent of blowback, so to speak, that this particular grill offers. A witness that night claims Tamela was eating right before bed close to 2 a.m., so it would not be out of the question that someone drunk, high, and on Xanax would attempt to light the grill to make something to eat. Munchies at this time of night are a thing, and if Tamela was caught off guard and perhaps stumbled backward while lighting the grill, she could have easily fallen down that dangerous stairwell because it would have been right behind her. And again, she's high, she's on Xanax, and she's drunk, and those things are conducive to having an accident. We certainly don't know what happened, and this is only a possibility, but let's examine the structure for a moment. Come with me on a tour of the deck, and I think you'll see a lot of very familiar elements to cases we've covered in the past. Let's say we're at the far end of the deck that is opposite the grill and stairs. Now, let's place two familiar true crime people who deserve justice into this narrative as us. Libby German and Abby Williams from the Delphi case. Pretend that deck overlooking the yard is actually the Monon High Bridge overlooking the creek. We're at one end, the starting point. The planks that span the deck are like the ties along the railroad trestle. Now, what is the word we associate with this construction? We call them railroad tracks, right? So we need our tracks here, and also need a facade of the white light crossing the tracks in the form of the perpetrator. In Delphi, it's the perpetrator with the white scarf leading up to the head, or deity, so here we need something white that leads up to Tamela's head, as she's the perpetrator in this accident, so to speak, and also we need something that indicates that the white light is combined with crossing tracks. Therefore, she's wearing white pajamas that lead up her body to her head, and they're covered in crossing patterns of paw prints, which are commonly called tracks. Now, think of the Delphi girls crossing the bridge and apply it to the deck. When do they merge with the person who turns out to be the red-shifted light, meaning the perpetrator over their shoulders closing in, the death? At the opposite end of the bridge, right, when they reach the culmination. Now, when they arrive there, in what direction does the perpetrator, or red-shifted light, take them? It takes them left. Furthermore, when they turn left, where are they specifically going? Down the hill. And when they are sent left, down the hill, what evidence seemed to emerge in the aftermath? One of them seemed to have slipped and fallen. Now, after that, when they reach the bottom of the hill, what do? They cross the abyss of the creek. And then what happens? They die, meaning their bodies are left on the other side right after crossing that barrier onto land again. So what most likely happened with Tamela will reflect that same construction because there is only one story presented in what we believe could be perhaps infinite ways. I could recite this same story to you from 1,000 tragic events or 10,000. It's all the same thing. Here's another one for you, The Sopranos. AJ is a spoiled brat and has a girlfriend that's going through some similar struggles, but he'll never grow up if he keeps being indulged. So the biggest and most expensive gift that he ever received from his parents, a new SUV, takes him and his girlfriend to the end of a bridge where the universe tells AJ and his girlfriend to leave childhood, aka kill the child, by going down the hill, and specifically by the vehicle going up in a ball of flames. So when the red-shifted light comes, or the fire, they are obviously, again, at the end of the bridge, just like we're talking about here, or in the Monon High Bridge, and it sends them down the hill below the bridge next to the water and leaves them with no way to get back to their childhood, symbolized by the burning vehicle. Their childhoods die at the bottom of that hill. Obviously, AJ's dad, who bought the SUV, is going to be pissed, and it's from here on out that he goes through a long depression mourning his childhood and ultimately realizes he must become an adult, something hammered home in the finale with Dad getting whacked. In Stand By Me, a group of four boys loses their childhood upon the discovery of a peer's dead body, and to get to that place, they have to cross a very dangerous elevated railroad trestle over water where a moving train forces them down the hill at the culmination. And what happens to the protagonist specifically in that place? He falls and gets injured, symbolically foreshadowing the death of his childhood to come. The red-shifted light, or the train, comes up behind them and pushes them forward, which equates to the plight of our emotional world using the past to facilitate the necessity of growth moving into the future. The boys and train converge at the end of the bridge before the boys fall down the hill. Long story short, that's likely what would have happened here. Let's follow the narrative, and we'll see that the pieces fit in this puzzle. Tamala crosses the deck, aka the bridge, so she should intersect with the red-shifted light at the end, the culmination, causing her to leave the spot where she's standing and go down the hill due to danger that is literally behind her to symbolize the past. So let's put Tamala at the culmination of those planks of wood at the end of our railroad trestle, which is the end of the deck, right? And where is she standing? Right next to the grill. So, what sends people down the hill? The red shifted light, or red giant, which specifically speaks to what? Expansion, leading to death. A red giant expands outward and becomes massive, and then it implodes upon itself, which is exactly what we see when you light a barbecue. And again, as we see in the examples provided, sometimes it literally comes as fire, like with AJ Soprano, and other times, like in Delphi, it's a man with a bladed instrument who is going to spill pooling blood, manifesting the idea of the expanding red giant. Either way, the red giant is death. So if we cross that bridge of the deck to the culmination at the other side, what is there that is not only capable of producing the manifested version of that red giant of death, but one that dictates that if it occurred, the danger would still be behind you because it symbolizes the past? It has to be something that creates a fall down the hill, just like the red-shifted light or red giant of the perpetrator sending the girls in Delphi down the hill. Well, if you were standing at the grill on this deck and facing it and jumped or stumbled away from the flame when it expanded outward, the real danger is that the unprotected stairwell is directly behind you. So if the red giant is what makes us go down the hill, did Tamala light the grill, stumble backward, and fall downstairs? And of course, is it possible that she did the same with a cigarette, and of course the grill wasn't involved, which might be more likely? Her injuries, and especially the compound fracture of the wrist, seem to say that this is a distinct possibility. But in order to get a better idea, let's go down the hill now and complete the structure to see if it adheres to the necessity of the symbolic narrative. Now a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp. One of the difficulties I find in dealing with my own issues is that, when I feel overwhelmed, I tend to make the problems a focal point instead of what really matters. Solutions. And when I get stuck in this place, it reminds me that it's time to take proactive measures in search of the clarity that will take me forward. Even still, sometimes we can't do it alone. We need help on the path to creating a better mindset. I've learned that a therapist can assist in reaching this goal, and in turn, also improve my awareness of how to manage negativity life throws my way. I was inspired to try therapy initially because of a loss in the family, but soon learned it had benefits beyond the scope of grief, from personal to professional. BetterHelp is affordable, accessible, and best of all, entirely online, making it a wonderful alternative to traditional therapy. A brief survey is all it takes to be matched with a therapist, and you have the option to switch therapists at any time. When you want to be a better problem solver, therapy can get you there. Visit BetterHelp.com/CCMM today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp.com/CCMM. Now, what's at the bottom of a hill in these narratives? The abyss. In Delphi, it's a creek. In Stand By Me, it's a river. And in The Sopranos, it was also a creek. But most of us don't have a creek in our backyard. So how do we accommodate the abyss here? Well, the first thing you notice about the patio is that it isn't a hard surface. It's comprised entirely of small stones or pebbles, and then the border surrounding it is made up of slightly larger stones. Why is that? Well, it's obvious that with the sloping yard going from the front to the back, a lot of rainwater is going to pool in the areas along the back of the house where the basement is exposed. So to absorb some of those potential floodwaters pooling around there on hard surfaces, the stone allows better drainage and less stagnancy. Basically, it facilitates the movement of water, which is exactly what a rocky creek bed does too. So, here, that patio at the bottom of the hill, so to speak, constitutes the abyss. Now, here's where the Delphi story will help us even more with our structure. So if Tamala falls down the stairs and dies at the bottom of the hill, we have an oh shit moment in which the homeowner and the person who supplied the Xanax have extreme levels of liability. Of course, we also see Tamala wouldn't be able to finish her journey across the abyss if she died at the bottom of the hill, aka the bottom of the stairs. So let's allow the Delphi case to help us understand how she might get across the abyss and over that metal barrier I mentioned. Of course, we also see Tamala wouldn't be able to finish her journey across the abyss if she died at the bottom of the hill. So let's allow the Delphi case to help us understand how she would get across the abyss and over that metal barrier I mentioned, which would be the equivalent of the water's edge. Well, in the Delphi case, investigators suggested that it looked like one of the girls had been dragged by the male perpetrator over the bank or barrier on the other side of the creek when they completed their crossing. Of course, we know their bodies were left just beyond that point. So, let's ask ourselves, how would Tamala's body get from the base of the patio staircase across the abyss of the patio surface and over the metal barrier or lip on the other side that serves as the bank on the shore of the creek? Obviously, somebody would drag her over that barrier. Now, of course, at the creek, water is what would end up on the bank. But here, since she's being dragged across rocks, like a creek bed, those rocks would spill out onto the grass. And this is the point I'm laughing hysterically, because the structure dictates the universe will utilize irony in this situation, in turn creating comedy gold in a very dark and disturbing situation. Ask yourself, if there was a dead body at your home and collectively the people present decided to move it, which member of the family would be most likely to do it? Clearly, it's the man of the house, in most cases where such a person is present. So here, who is essentially the man of the house, more or less, because he's closest to actually fulfilling the role? That would be the homeowner's boyfriend, Jose. Do you want me to mention right now that he was allegedly later fired from his job due to misconduct, and the particular misconduct in question is that he illegally accessed the file on this case to learn details police didn't share? Okay. Now, let's say hypothetically that this person dragged Tamala onto the lawn and placed her under the balcony, along with placing the propane tank above on the deck. It suddenly looks like Tamala fell from the balcony, and it was her fault instead of the homeowner's. But in the back of this dude's mind, and perhaps in yours right now too, he knows they're still potentially screwed. And why? You can't manipulate the Xanax in her system. Now there's no way to say, oh, she was smoking weed, which was hers, and she fell, despite the fact we tried to stop her from smoking weed earlier. Of course, if we recall from earlier, who did the homeowner say was offended by the weed smoking? Jose. So who would be most likely to blame this on the weed? Jose. And if he was the one who dragged her, that irony will produce comedy. It's structural inevitability. So to give him the middle finger, look what the universe does. Picture him pulling her from the stones onto the grass, and having that action leave stones on the grass afterward, meaning combined. What's another way to say somebody smoked weed and got high? They're stoned on grass. So here, nature leaves stones on the grass, but what's missing? Xanax. It's saying exactly what this person wants it to say, but in the least helpful, worst way possible. The universe is designed to project your emotional failures back at you with symbolic imagery. The issue here is emotional, not physical, meaning these people don't need to move the body, they need to call the police and tell the truth. So when whomever potentially moved that body acted, the message being sent in physicality, symbolized by the Xanax being inside the body and inaccessible physically, is that the issue, the real issue, is internal or emotional and not physical. However, sociopathy arises as a shortcut to emotional change when people fear loss. So as they act in such situations, the universe simply mirrors not only their fears, but also solutions. Supposedly, when Tamala's husband was contacted after the incident, he was told his wife tripped over the metal lip serving as a barrier for the patio and died. In the 911 call, it seems to be Jose who suggests that Tamala fell from the balcony. It's also said on the call that she had a cut on her wrist, as though someone was insinuating this was perhaps a suicide, when in reality, it was a compound fracture. The bone was sticking out. Now, think about the narrative I just offered of Tamala being dragged onto the grass, and let's revisit the positioning of the body. She's found face down, with her arms directly at her sides and palms up. A police officer later said that he moved one of her arms to take a pulse, and so we find her with a curved arm later on. Now, does that position, with arms directly at her sides and palms up, occur to you as a position in which somebody would likely fall and die? Or one in which a person had been dragged by the armpits onto the lawn? We have to remember the serious and bloody injury to the right wrist. Touching her wrists or hands would be out of the question, so dragging her by the armpits would be far more sensible. The way the scene looks, it's actually a hybrid between making it seem like Tamala fell from above on the deck and also making it seem as though she tripped over the metal lip around the patio. Unfortunately, neither possibility suffices in rationalizing the origin of her injuries. Plus, a fall from the deck onto the ground would be loud, and with the basement windows where the homeowner's aunt lives being so close, it's difficult for me to envision a scenario in which nobody heard her body hitting the ground. We can't know for sure what happened given the available evidence, but here's where it gets really shady. We're told that Tamala was seen eating a bowl of gumbo before bed and had specifically told a person passing through the kitchen that she was going to have one last cigarette before that. At the same time, one of the guests had her husband pick her up, which was supposedly at 1:47 a.m., and she claims that Tamala accompanied her to the door, whereupon they hugged before she walked out and closed the door behind her. Apparently, when the husband was interviewed, he said his wife came to the door alone. Tamala wasn't there. Of course, this is a very nice home in a good neighborhood, so you'd think they'd have some type of security surveillance, right? And they do. But wouldn't you know it? The cameras weren't working that night, and the excuse given was that their batteries were dead. Supposedly, the cops didn't even bother to check. So what normally would have been captured on video was supposedly not, and it seems the police never made any effort to confirm that was the truth. Now we arrive at the door log. Like many security systems these days, the one at this home allows you to receive notifications when doors open and close. On the night of Tamala's death, somebody opened the garage door at 1:39 a.m., meaning the door leading from the interior of the house into the garage, and it closed at 1:40 p.m. It opened again at 1:40 a.m. and remained open all night from that point. Likewise, the back door leading out to the deck from the kitchen opened at 1:49 a.m. and closed at 1:50. It then opened again at 1:57 and remained open all night. Very interesting. In the early morning hours of November 4th, 2018, between 12 a.m. and 6 a.m., the high temperature in Cumming, Georgia was 46 degrees and the low was 45. It's many hours after sunset, and with a temperature like that, an open door would produce a highly recognizable draft of cold air that would lead someone to shut it. But they don't. Nobody shuts the garage door either. And why? The most likely scenario is that someone, or even multiple people, traveled back and forth between the garage and the deck numerous times, which indicates the necessity of utility, as a garage is where we keep things related to working outside. So, we have both a door to the garage and a door to the deck open all night. So, what I think happened is that, due to the necessity of moving back and forth, and doing so over a significant period of time in which these people claim to be asleep, and also making it seem as though Tamala went out back onto the deck and never returned, the doors were simply left ajar, meaning closed but not sealed shut, so to speak, preventing a massive draft, but still fooling the sensors into believing the doors were left wide open. Beyond that, somebody opened the front door at 4:10 a.m. So, was everyone in the house actually asleep since 2 a.m.? It certainly does not seem that way, and I haven't seen any sort of justification for who went in the garage or why. Moreover, are we sure this incident didn't happen much earlier in the night? This was a slumber party, and multiple women supposedly left at 10:30 p.m. to go home. Again, another says she left close to 2 a.m., but Tamala didn't seem to be at the door like she said. Is it possible the person claiming to see Tamala eating a bowl of gumbo actually saw her doing it earlier in the night, and she actually died hours earlier? Of course, it's possible. Law enforcement simply did not take control of this scene in the context of a crime. This was much more of a good old boy situation, and if you don't believe me, the lead detective initially assigned to the case referred to Tamala as quote-unquote porch lady. it seems that from the moment this happened, the parties involved felt they would be entitled to minimal scrutiny, and clearly they were. Sadly, the basis for that belief is probably rooted in the fact Tamla was the lone black woman in a house full of white people. They knew it was advantageous to their cause, and I wonder if we'd have seen the same shoddy result if she was white. Something tells me the police and an ambulance would have arrived in time and that there would have been greater scrutiny placed upon everyone present. Beyond that, one of the women who was interviewed by the police showed up to her interview with gift cards from Dunkin' Donuts for them. Now, think about the physical manifestation of her emotional problem there. What does a gift card give you, right? Someone gives you a gift card, everything you get with it is what? Free. So you have freedom. So she brings a manifestation of freedom to the police in a situation in which she's being questioned about this person's death. And so it's fairly obvious that there is some guilt going on there and some fear involving her what? Her freedom. So the police obviously refuse the Dunkin' Donuts cards, but it's kind of obvious what's going on here. So in the end, I can only speculate based on available information, but I believe this death was probably an accident precipitated either when lighting a cigarette or lighting the grill or something similar in the area of the unprotected stairwell while intoxicated, leading to a stumble followed by a fatal fall in which the homeowner and other interested parties, such as the person with the Xanax, realized the enormous extent of their liability and physically altered the narrative. I do not believe a murder occurred, but what seems to have happened isn't any better. We might never know the truth, but ultimately, Tamla Horsford and her loved ones deserved better, and I do believe that race played a part in this neglect. So, to close this out, I think the message I want to send is that we have to correct this ugliness. The victim in this case was seemingly denied the dignity of having the full truth come to light, which means that all those who survived her carry that burden, and worse, they do it without her. We can't change what happened, but if we always question the truth as lies, we can fight to ensure that the lost are never forgotten.